Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Wednesday, September 5th, right in the middle of your work week. 14 minutes past the hour, and we are having a good time here on WWGH Radio. We thank legendary actor Bill Macy for joining us in hour number one. Always a lot of fun to catch up with Bill and see what he is doing. Now, this hour, as we always say, there's always something going on in the news, but yesterday, after the Labor Day holiday, was a particularly busy day between the Supreme Court hearings for Judge Kavanaugh, some audio, some excerpts being leaked of the new Bob Woodward book on President Trump that's entitled Fear, that will be out next week on September 11th, between the tweets about Attorney General Jeff Sessions, John McCain's funeral, and the remarks that were made there. There's stuff going on left, right, and sideways, and no better person to catch up with all that on than one of my favorite guests around here, a panelist on the McLaughlin Group and writer for the Daily Beast, Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, here we are after Labor Day, and Labor Day was slow, but right after, here we went.
Yes, and it's a short week. It's already Wednesday, halfway through Wednesday, and you're right. I mean, the debut of the Woodward book yesterday, theoretically it's not out until next week, but the Washington Post had excerpts, and then CNN got a copy. And then Bob Woodward revealed a phone conversation between himself and the president about whether the president knew that Woodward was doing a book and wanted to interview him. And that was quite fascinating. I must say the marketing of this book has been first rate, the timing, the fact that you can listen to the president saying, well, if he'd known that Bob Woodward wanted to talk to him, he would have done it. Why didn't he call him? And Woodward said he'd talked to six people in the White House and also to Senator Lindsey Graham about getting the word to the president that he wanted to talk to him. And Woodward said, is that not true? And the president said, well, Lindsey mentioned to him, but it was just casual. And then he put Kellyanne Conway on the phone, who had to basically explain away that, yes, she had lunch with Bob Woodward to discuss his access for the book. And the president was kind of pretending he had no idea this was happening and, oh, now it's all fiction and whatever. But lots of important people are quoted in this book. They may not have been quoted directly from their mouths, but Woodward is a master at putting together scenes and triangulating all the people who were present and getting the quotes that he's getting. And so I'm wondering how the president is going to, after a round of initial tweets, are there going to be firings of some of the people who, you know, who are caught speaking ill of him out of school? So it's another devastating portrait of the chaos inside the White House in a way we knew about, but I think it adds a dimension about national security and how Secretary of Defense James Mattis in particular is, serving as a, guardrail against what this president sometimes wants to do impulsively. It's quite an extraordinary picture.
You know, Eleanor, the thing that struck me yesterday when I heard the phone conversation between Bob Woodward and President Trump, now it's my understanding, as I was watching CNN, that the president knew that that conversation was being recorded. And yet...
Well, Trump, Woodward said to him, I'm recording this. Yes,
right,
he
right.
told him. He didn't do it secretively.
And yet the president did not... I mean, he did tell untruths, but then he contradicted himself, and yet he knew he was being recorded. I couldn't quite explain why he would do that. He knew he was being recorded.
Yeah. He's impulsive. He just goes with what, you know, pops into his mind and what makes sense to him at the given moment. I don't think he calculates how it's being received. After this conversation with Woodward, where he says, "I don't blame you entirely," and President was quite he was polite, but then out come the tweets and this is all fake news and it's all made up. But I think the White House is going to have a very difficult time refuting this because of the way Woodward works. It's been described to me, he has a whole like floor of his house in Georgetown, which is like a studio with all these record. He tapes everything, and he has an assistant who transcribes everything. And so he has these banks of tapes for every one of the books that he's done, and he's done 17 books. And so the only time I can remember Bob Woodward's veracity being questioned was a book about the Iran-Contra affair during the Reagan administration, and Bill Casey, who was the CIA director, was in the hospital in a coma. And as I recall, Bob Woodward somehow got into that hospital room, and he, in that book, has a whole conversation with Casey, and people questioned whether that really could have been happened. That's the only time I can recall in all these years that he's come under any kind of fire. And so I think he can defend everything in this current book. And the president's defense is, I look at the good job I'm doing. I may have a different kind of management style, but, you know, the economy's roaring. We're on the road to peace with North Korea. We're not at war. I mean, the White House put out a whole long list of his, you know, supposed accomplishments to offset the chaos that that the Woodward book and previous books have depicted. This is nothing new, really, but it's crazy town, I think, is the expression that he quotes Chief of Staff John Kelly using. This is crazy town. And that's consistent with all the other reporting we've had about this White House.
You know, it's interesting, Eleanor, because what I kept thinking yesterday was obviously Bob Woodward has a very great record when it comes to writing these books and having sources for everything he puts in there. But the people working for the Trump White House who had to have heard these quotes or at least relayed these quotes, why would they do that? Because this is pretty horrific compared to what else was Bob Woodward's done in the past.
Yeah. Why would they do that? I think, you know, people can't quite believe the situation they're in, and they confide in others, and stories gets out. That's kind of how, it's kind of like the old party line in the telephone, and maybe it gets embellished. Maybe not, but Woodward's defense has always said he has more than one source for the quotes. And then I think the people that are there, they actually, or many of the people that are there, they want the storyline to get out that they're there because they're working for the greater good of the country, and they're protecting us from the worst impulses of a president who has virtually no impulse control. And I think they want to be understood for that, as opposed to castigated for staying on and enabling this president, or, you know, acceding to all his worst impulses. Because I think a lot of people who work in the administration get asked, you know, why are you here? You know, how can you continue to work for him? Why aren't you staging a rebellion? And what they want us to know collectively is that they're trying to, you know, protect the country. I think James Mattis in particular, and I guess John Kelly as well, that they worry about national security. I mean, there's one story in the book that the president wanted to assassinate the Syrian president Assad, wondered why he couldn't do that. And he has really very simplistic views about how you handle foreign policy crises. And I think the way the story is in the book, Mattis tells the president, well, we'll get right on that, but, you know, doesn't do anything, and the president soon moves on to the next drama or crisis that he creates. And I think the opening anecdote in the book is Gary Cohn, who was the former economic advisor, who actually took some papers off of his desk, the president's desk. I think it was papers that would have taken the U.S. out of the U.S.-South Korea trade deal, and he just removed them, and the president kind of forgot about it. So that's what's going on in this White House. I mean, it all has the ring of truth, I must say, and you put it up against that first book, Fire and Fury, I guess, written by Michael Wolff, and then you had Omarosa's book recently called Unhinged, but neither of those authors had the sort of the journalistic creds of a Bob Woodward, which is what makes this book different.
You know, Eleanor, something yesterday, it was kind of almost a side story between the Supreme Court and the leaking of excerpts from this book, was the fact that the New York Times was reporting that Mueller was willing to accept the president's written responses in regard to Russia, but not obstruction of justice. And one of the quotes that was leaked from the Woodward book was from John Dowd, who was the president's former personal attorney, from January 27th, in which he quotes Woodward, quotes John Dowd, as saying, "Don't testify, it's either that or an orange jumpsuit." And the reason that sticks out to me is that obviously perjury. We've heard perjury trap. We've heard that over and over. But Bill Clinton committed perjury, and he wasn't removed from office for it. Certainly did not end up in an orange jumpsuit. Richard Nixon lied. I don't know that he lied under oath, but he lied. He didn't end up in an orange jumpsuit. Why that particular phrase? Because I would think John Dowd would get the idea that perjury for a president is bad, but it's probably not going to end you up in prison.
Well, I think it's a figment of speech. I mean, he just wanted to get across how serious this is. And, perjury, President Clinton was impeached for perjury. He wasn't convicted because a Republican Senate did not come up with 67 votes to convict him. And I suppose, you know, this president could probably calculate that even if a Democratic House impeaches him, that it's unlikely a Senate narrowly controlled by Republicans or Democrats could convict him. But I think the president is also facing a lot of other investigations having to do with financial improprieties, the ones brought in New York, for example. I think there's every reason to believe that money laundering over a long period of time could be uncovered. And, you know, those things could well result in jail time. So I think when John Dowd used that expression, I think he's trying to get across just how serious the problems are that this president faces. It's not solely the question of impeachment and an unlikely conviction by a Senate next year, but it's also financial crimes, and I think financial crimes that could well echo what we saw Paul Manafort being tried for, and Manafort is now facing a second trial in the District of Columbia. I think there's a lot more to go, a lot more, string to unravel from this ball of of contradictions that that is this president.
You know, it's interesting, Eleanor, because if the New York Times reporting is right, and that Mueller, these apparently are the two issues that he wants to question the president on, Russian collusion and obstruction of justice, doesn't that mean that in some way he's got some idea that this has happened? Because up until this point, there's really been no assumption that it did happen. Because I think it's interesting how that was put.
Well, I think putting together a legal case and laying it all out in a report is what is, that's Mueller's challenge. If you look at collusion, I mean, a certain amount of collusion went on because we can see it. I mean, the meeting at Trump Tower, the president openly saying to, you know, Russia, if you're listening, we'd like to see Hillary Clinton's emails, and the next day the hacking begins of her campaign chairman's email account, and the leaked emails begin. So I think, you know, he can document that. Look at all of the Russians that he's indicted. So I think there are some dots that have to be connected there, but I think it's pretty obvious that there's a case there, or at least a report laying this all out. And then obstruction of justice. Again, the president, by firing James Comey, by all of the things he said about the current attorney general and what we know sort of on background about his feelings of wanting to end the Russia investigation, again, I think that there is a case to be made there, but it's up to Mueller to lay out the legal foundation and to, you know, again, to connect all the dots. I think there's plenty there that we know about already, and a lot more that we should learn once Mueller completes his investigation.
Well, it's interesting because, like you correctly mentioned there, we do know that President Trump called on Russia to look for Hillary Clinton's emails. We do know he fired James Comey. I don't know that Mueller would ask him those questions because he knows that it happened. Everybody knows it happened. We all saw it on national television. So it's interesting that there are more questions about all of that. Because I, you know, this whole interview with the president, which seemingly is what is hanging up this investigation, is strange, because we obviously know that his people don't want him to do it. They're afraid he'll perjure himself. But Mueller obviously wants to talk to him for some reason, things that obviously he did not say publicly.
Well, I think to make a case of obstruction of justice, you need more than just the things that he's done. You need to understand the intent. Is there criminal intent? And I think that's why Mueller wants to talk to Trump to find out, you know, what was he thinking, was it really a violation the way he acted because of his intent? And it's interesting because the president is kind of convinced that if he can sit down with Mueller, he can charm him, he can convince him of anything, because the president, again, has convinced himself, I'm sure, of his innocence, whether he truly believes it or he's just rationalizing it. But the lawyers are the ones who are holding him back, who think that, you know, he's not really capable of making a solid case for himself because his statements are all over the lot. He can't stick to any one particular defense, and so they don't want him to sit down. You know, I remember Bill Clinton, he settled for Starr and a group of his attorneys came to the White House and interviewed Clinton, and they videotaped it. And Judge Kavanaugh, well, he was not yet a judge. He was one of Starr's attorneys. Attorney Brett Kavanaugh wrote a lot of suggested questions to ask the president, and they were very detailed, really lurid questions. In the end, Starr elected not to ask those questions, and Kavanaugh was not there when the president was questioned. But it's interesting how he was a player then, and now he's before the Senate confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court, when the whole issue of executive power and executive authority could very likely come before the Supreme Court if the Mueller probe chooses to press the president for an interview, and if the president declines, does Mueller subpoena him, or does he kind of take his request to the higher court? So these two strands are now coming together in the Kavanaugh hearings, which got underway yesterday on Capitol Hill.
You know, it's interesting with Mueller, because I think that's what a lot of people in the middle ground, in the Midwest, in the middle country are wondering, is why is there this conversation that's been going on for a long time about should the president sit down with Mueller? Because now we're getting to a Supreme Court pick. If Mueller wanted to talk to him, I mean, wouldn't you just issue the subpoena and see what happened? Because if Kavanaugh gets on there,
it's... I think it's a big step to subpoena a sitting president. I believe it's never been done. There's some question as to whether it's constitutional. And I think Mueller is a very cautious litigator. He is, playing everything by the book. I think if he took that step, he'd probably have to clear that with Rod Rosenstein, who is overseeing the probe from the Justice Department. And they all know they're playing with a very explosive president. And so, I think they want to make sure that they have everything nailed down in this investigation before they make any moves towards President Trump.
You know, legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin on CNN, I believe it was yesterday as well, said the president's tweet about Jeff Sessions about investigating the two congressmen, indicting, that he shouldn't have done that, he did that for political reasons because they're Trump supporters, that in and of itself, that tweet is impeachable.
Well, it's obstruction of justice, but it's not in line with the Mueller probe. And again, it's a tweet. It's not an order. he didn't order Sessions not to go ahead with the probe of New York Congressman Chris Collins for insider trading. Blatant. He was caught on the phone at the White House picnic, calling from the grounds of the White House to members of his family and associates to sell quickly a particular stock because it was a medical stock and it had failed some clinical trials. And then the other is, and Collins had been the first Republican member of Congress to back Trump. And then second was Duncan Hunter, the California congressman, who's been indicted on corruption after using campaign money to pay his children's private school tuition, pay his golfing fees, his vacation expenses, even flying the family's pet rabbit across the country. I mean, I like rabbits, but I think they could have paid for that themselves. So, and Hunter was the second Republican to back the president in the Congress. So the president is suggesting that they've only been indicted because they're Republicans. I mean, it's nonsensical. And so the Justice Department is, I don't believe, they're going to slow walk that or stop that. So I greatly admire Jeffrey Toobin, but I don't know if the tweet would rise to the level of impeachable defense. If he took more active measures to shut down those investigations, then we'd be talking some serious legal problems. But in my time in Washington, I mean, ever since post-Watergate, presidents have been really careful about not treading on the integrity of the Justice Department. It's understood that there's a line between the Justice Department and the White House. This president seems to think that Eric Holder, who was President Obama's Attorney General, that Eric Holder did nothing but protect Obama while he was there, and he Trump would like an Attorney General who protects him the same way. It's really a misreading of history, of Holder's role, of what Sessions' role should be, and we have a president who acts on his impulses, who's not a student of history, doesn't really understand the boundaries and what we used to consider normal in Washington. And everybody every day tries to come to grips with that. Do you protest? Do you resist? Do you go along with it and normalize it? So I think you have a lot of angst in Washington, certainly on the part of Democrats and among a lot of Republicans too, who really are not happy with the way this president behaves or the direction of their party, but they worry about getting reelected, and they see how passionate the Trump base is, and they don't want to cross swords with the Trump voters, and so that's what's keeping Republicans in line going up to the midterm elections. They're afraid they'll be in worse shape if they abandon this president than if they stick with him.
You know, Eleanor, as this thing goes on, this investigation, the Mueller probe, something that is interesting to me is that it started out collusion, the Trump campaign, collusion with Russia during the 2016 election. Now, Paul Manafort is possibly going to jail, Papadopoulos, Flynn, who knows what the sentence will be there, Michael Cohen, all these people now have been plea deals, charges, trials, sentencing, and yet nothing yet about this collusion where it all started. Now, if Mueller comes back with nothing to see here on this, none of these people probably would have ended up in trouble if this investigation had never started. Is it possible there is still a chance of nothing to see here?
I think that's highly unlikely. And but you're right. If Manafort had not raised his hand to be Trump's campaign manager in 2016, he could probably still go on, collecting the big bucks from, dealing with Russian oligarchs. It's why I think generally billionaires don't run for public office, because of the scrutiny that's involved. And this president got away with not revealing his income tax returns, which probably should have been the first tip-off that there was something he doesn't want us to see. I'd be amazed if Mueller comes up with a report. He will do a report, and he will give it to the Justice Department, to Rod Rosenstein, and then Rosenstein decides what to do with it. Does he just shelve it and say, this does not rise to the level of a crime? Does he refer it to the House of Representatives? Does he suggest that Mueller go ahead and subpoena the president? I think those decisions are really Rod Rosenstein's to make. I suppose it's possible that he could decide that whatever Mueller comes up with does not rise to the level of an impeachable offense or a prosecutable offense, and just decide not to go ahead with it. There have been many special prosecutors over the years. During the Clinton years, just about every cabinet member went through an investigation with a special counsel, and some of them did end in sort of acquittal or furthering of charges. I think that's possible, but I think the possibility is quite small.
That being said, I heard a lot of people kind of gasp on Friday because they felt that Labor Day was the cutoff point before the elections for Mueller to reveal this election. That if he didn't do anything by Labor Day, he was not going to do it, just so it would not impact the November elections. But I've heard other people say that he has until the end, he would wait until the end of September for that. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I think it's not a written rule, but it's kind of an unofficial Justice Department rule that in the 60 days before an election, that you don't take any kind of public stand that could impact an election. Now, James Comey violated that with Hillary when he reopened the investigation into her email, only to close it several days later, and just, I think, 3 days before the election. That definitely had an impact on the election. And I think Mueller, again, he's a by-the-book prosecutor, and I think he will be mindful of all of the blowback that Comey got for what he did. And so I guess I think that Mueller's probably going to go dark during this period of time, and that would be 60 days, September, October. Yeah, I think once the campaigns get fully underway in the next week or two, I suppose he could, you know, if he had an indictment, say, of Roger Stone, which has been much rumored, he could probably do that in the next 10 days. But I'm inclined to think that he's going to lay low and wait until after the election.
Well, it's interesting because one thing that has been looming is the postponement of the sentencing for Michael Flynn. Now, it might be that the report by Mueller does not come out, but I would think that at some point between now and November, the sentencing for Michael Flynn is going to happen. And this questioning that he's kept him for, I wouldn't think it's for the Manafort case because that's already in motion. So he keeps getting from Flynn, apparently it's the gift that keeps on giving, whatever it is.
Yeah, well, Flynn has been cooperating for some time, and he's been as mum as Mueller. And in the Woodward book, for example, it's clear that the former Secretary of State, Tillerson, and the former National Security Advisor, H.R. McMasters, obviously talked to Woodward and helped, but I don't see any fingerprints of Flynn talking to Mueller, so he's been pretty quiet. But in terms of the Manafort, you know, the once that trial is put on the docket, and then it will take, they have to, you know, go through, name the juror, probably have a week or two weeks maybe of testimony. So you could get another Manafort verdict early in October. I think that's highly likely, but that's kind of out of Mueller's control. I mean, once that was set in motion, but you know, that would be another you know, blow to Trump and the Republican Party going into the midterms. Although, having said that, nothing appears to shake his base, but it's people who voted for Trump, wanting a change, not liking Hillary, thinking it'd be fun to shake things up. I think some of those folks are maybe peeling off now. Whether they can vote for a Democrat or whether they just stay home, I think, you know, Republicans are worried about what they call the energy gap. I mean, the Democrats are really excited about the midterms and the change that they might possibly bring about. And Republicans are really in much more of a defensive mode.
You know, Eleanor, I want to talk a bit about the Supreme Court in our last 14 minutes here, but something happened over the weekend that I thought was kind of peculiar. We had Joe Biden being asked if he would run for president. He was at the Labor Day event in Pittsburgh. John Kerry did not close the door on running again for president. Bernie Sanders was down campaigning for the candidate who got the nod on the Democratic side for the Florida's governor's race, not the establishment candidate. it's clear that Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, and John Kerry, if nothing else, they're thinking about it. And they, I don't know, they're all older than Hillary Clinton, they're all older than the president, and they all have lost at some point. It's interesting this is the group, because I would imagine after this election, we're going to start seeing a lot of people declare things.
Yes, and I think, the three names you mentioned, they're all the old guard, and frankly, I think if there were a presidential election held today, any one of them could probably win and defeat Trump. But now, who is going to have the interest and the stamina to go through the whole primary process, probably with 17 other candidates and a series of debates until the Democrats come up with a nominee? I think Vice President Biden, I think he probably is serious about running. He's a couple years older than Trump, not much, and he looks like he's in pretty good shape, unlike the president. So, and I think, Biden's love of politics is just unbounded, and I think if he sees an opening here that might be his last, he might well take it. Now, John Kerry, I know he's expressed interest. He also has a memoir, a book out now that he's promoting. You're always a lot more interesting if you might possibly run for president, so I don't know that he's taken any official steps. I think that's what we have to start looking for after the midterms and early next year, is who is starting to take, concrete steps, hiring people, raising money, doing what you have to do to run for president. And then the other end of the spectrum from that old guard, you have Beto O'Rourke in Texas, who's running a powerful, inspirational campaign against Ted Cruz in Texas. Now, he may win. It would be a long shot. He may lose narrowly or whatever, but he seems to have touched a nerve among Democrats who see him as their next Barack Obama, coming out of nowhere and, talking the talk and really being able to relate to people. So he's the other end of the spectrum, and in between you have governors, senators, a whole host of people who are interested in putting their hat in the ring for the presidency.
I'll tell you, interestingly enough, somebody who we've been hearing a lot of lately as we transition here into the Supreme Court is Hillary Clinton. Just in the last 2 days, on Labor Day, she tweeted, "Happy Labor Day. There's no better time to talk about why workers' rights would suffer if Brett Kavanaugh, whose hearings for a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court could start tomorrow, is confirmed." Then yesterday, she said, "Do you have a pre-existing condition? Do you care about someone who has one? Could you or someone you love ever get one? Then you should call your senators today to hashtag stop Kavanaugh from getting a lifetime seat on the Supreme Court. Here is why." And then she posts an article. And then 4 hours ago, she says, "If Brett Kavanaugh becomes a Supreme Court justice, will he help overturn Roe versus Wade, which legalized abortion in America? Yes, of course he will." It sounds like she's getting a little more vocal as well.
Yeah, I do not see her running for president, but I think she's trying to give the Democrats a little bit of a push here as they protest Kavanaugh. And, the focus has been on the executive power question and his writings about that, and then on the overturning of Roe. But, the overturning of Obamacare and the fact that this administration is refusing to defend the provisions that require insurance companies to cover people without discrimination who have pre-existing conditions, it really does throw that element of the health care plan into doubt. That it hasn't gotten the attention it should. I'm glad she's spotlighting that. And then the question with Roe really isn't whether they're going to overturn the right. What they're going to do, with, I think, Kavanaugh's enthusiastic approval, is continue to chip away at it and making access to abortion so difficult that it's that the right barely exists. In Texas, there are now so few clinics and they're, you know, hundreds of miles apart. If you're, you know, seeking to end a pregnancy in its earliest weeks and months, and you have to travel a couple hundred miles, and then there's a waiting period, and you've got a couple of kids at home, and you're low income, it becomes almost impossible. And I think that's the kind of erosion that we will see in reproductive rights. I don't think overturning Roe could happen, yes, but there are so many other ways in the interim that they can make reproductive rights so difficult to access. That's already happened in this country.
You know, something interesting over the weekend, as I was watching John McCain's service on Saturday morning, one of the people who was there was former Vice President Al Gore. And what struck me was he lost the Supreme Court case, which was kind of highlighted Sunday night in the Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary. But he never came back and did anything, really. He just kind of drifted away. He came back a little in the last election in Florida and did some things with climate change. But really, I think it hurt him pretty badly. Hillary does right. seem to be out there. Now, I don't think she would ever run again either. But I do think if the story is collusion and if the story is that she should have won, would have won in this report, she likes to do town halls. She likes to tweet all of a sudden. She's written books. I don't know if she would just let that go and say, well, tough luck. They got one over on me.
Yeah, but I don't know what, you know, what she can do. And even if they do prove collusion, her critics can point to, you know, other so-called mistakes that she made. It's hard to say definitively, oh, this is what cost her the election. So I don't think there'll be that kind of finality to it where she would feel, you know, emboldened to stand up and say, yes, that presidency should have been mine, you know. So, and as for Al Gore, I think the whole experience was devastating for him. And remember, he kind of just dropped out of sight initially. He gained a lot of weight. He grew a beard. His marriage, his storybook marriage of many years, you know, broke up. He did invest his time in climate change. He wrote a couple of books. He's still out there. And you're right, he was at the McCain service in Washington. But I recently spoke to a good friend of his, and I said, you know, why doesn't he put his hat in the ring in 2020? I mean, he's another one who is, you could arguably say, was cheated out of the presidency. And the response was, you know, he won't and he shouldn't. I mean, that he doesn't have the, you got to have the fire in the belly for it. And, you know, Gore, although he was groomed to be president from a very young age, he was never a real fighter for it. And I think the way he lost just, you know, took all of that sort of gumption out of him. I think it's very sad. I think he would have been a good president.
You know, it's interesting, and I want to touch on the Supreme Court before we end here, but I was having this conversation with somebody yesterday about Hillary Clinton and the whole collusion idea, and essentially the conversation was, if it does come out that there was collusion, because we've always heard the narrative that Vladimir Putin did not like Hillary Clinton and did not want her to become president, and he said it himself in the little press conference he had with President Trump there. If the Democrats continue to say that she was just a bad candidate, that she didn't go to Wisconsin, that she didn't motivate people, that she wasn't the right one, then why did Donald Trump need collusion to win if she was just so horrible? Doesn't it kind of destroy
them? Remember how, you know, nobody thought Donald Trump would win. I don't think Donald Trump even thought he would win. I don't know that the Russians initially got involved because I think they just liked to sow disruption, and they saw more disruption if they came down on the Trump side. But Hillary looked like she was the commanding candidate all along, and I know too many people who thought Trump would win. And again, the Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury, you know, said that Melania Trump was actually crying on election night because she didn't really want to go to Washington and be first lady. And a lot of the people around him, including Paul Manafort, had basically seen the presidential campaign as a vehicle to line their pockets and make deals and that sort of thing. They didn't think it would actually end up in a presidency. And the transition planning that Vice President Pence was in charge of was virtually non-existent. So I think it was a big surprise and that he won. And he can make fun of Hillary now, but I'm sure he thought, like everybody else, that she was likely to beat him. Remember, he talked about the election was rigged, and he was kind of setting the stage, should he lose, to say it was rigged.
Well, it's a fascinating conversation to continue to have, because I think, like I've said before, the one thing in the Mueller indictments that fascinates me is that we now know they did hack into the voter rolls. And I'm curious to know how Mueller knows that if votes were not changed. How do they know that they were in there? And that 500,000 right. people's information was compromised. And I the polls being off as far as they were, I could see Michigan and Wisconsin, but in Pennsylvania, they had her ahead 12 points at one point before the election. It just... Something does not seem right there on election night or before. I don't know. I would just like to know. I would just like to read the report for that reason. How do they know they got into 39 states' voter rolls? How do they know that?
Right. Well, you're right. They identified the states, and so there probably is more there than has been made public. I would hope that we would see that someday.
Final question, Eleanor, this thing, Supreme Court, is there any way to stop Kavanaugh? Is this all just a big show, what's going on with the protesters and the trying to stop the start of it yesterday?
Well, the Republicans have the votes, and if they have the votes, they may pick up some Democratic votes also from red states. I think it's going to be hard to stop him unless he implodes or explodes in some way, and I think that scene yesterday where the father of the 14-year-old who died in the, you know, approached and stuck out his hand and Kavanaugh spurned him and then sent his security detail out to, you know, to sort of find out what that was all about. Maybe Kavanaugh had no idea who it was, and now that he knows, he probably owes the gentleman an apology. That dominated the news this morning, but it'll take a lot more than that to, I think, shake public confidence in him. He's already rated very lowly as a Supreme Court candidate. He's somewhere between Robert Bork and Harriet Meyer, which were two failed nominations from long ago. But right now, it looks like he's likely to be confirmed.
With Roe versus Wade, the Affordable Care Act, the things Hillary Clinton's mentioning in her tweets, labor's rights. Is this the thing, if he is confirmed, that blows people out into the streets to protest anger? I would think women might be angry about this.
You would think, and there were some protests, but, you know, we're not seeing, you know, mass turnout in the streets. I mean, we have, you know, generations of women out there now who really don't know a time when abortion wasn't legal. And so I don't think they feel like that's truly threatened. There's been so much rhetoric. And that goes for all of the other, you know, it's as though Democrats have been warning about all of this for some time. And now it's finally coming to pass and nobody quite believes it. And so I don't think they've yet got the kind of grassroots protest that they would need. But, you know, just now getting into September, still awfully hot here in the Northeast, I think we may still see, you know, some stronger protests as it gets closer to confirmation.
It'll be Eleanor, always thank you for coming on. It's always a pleasure, and it'll be an interesting few months to be sure.
Absolutely. Okay.
Thank you, Eleanor.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.
All righty. Bye.
Eleanor Clifton, for me, for Scott Spears, this is the end of the show today. I'm heading for the dugout.
They're open Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. for prize pickup. The WWGH offices are located at 559 East Center Street in the lower level of the Belltone Building. Thank you so much for playing fair.
Marion Midget Football, 46th season, Sunday.